This is day three of this four-day December 2015 session, and I'm going to continue reading from this book, Illuminating Silence, words of Master Sheng Yen, and compiled and edited by John Crook. Going to pick up where we left off. Ancient Chinese poem entitled Calming the Mind by Wang Ming. And the next stanza reads as follows. Water dripping ceaselessly will fill the four seas. Specks of dust not wiped away will become the five mountains. And then Sheng Yen comments, don't think that a tiny bit of wandering thought is irrelevant. Maybe there is only a tiny bit of wandering thought in this sitting, this day, this retreat. But the accumulation of these tiny wandering thoughts becomes one gigantic wandering thought, a monster. This habit has been formed since time without beginning. Endlessly we are judging things and one another by using our knowledge and our memory of past experiences. And this has been passed down from life to life. Indeed, it is karma itself. We are this habit, entangled and constrained within it, and of this we are unaware. Most people have no idea how many thoughts are going through their heads. First time they sit, often you can compare it to someone floating down a stream who suddenly attempts to stand in the stream bed, be overwhelmed by the force of that stream. Because we're going along with our thoughts so willingly, so unconsciously, we don't realize the effect. However, he says, when we focus in practice, it becomes quite easy to see the truth of this. We can see the scattered thoughts and how difficult it is to let them go. The endless cycling of our limited and caging ideas and judgments, our prejudices. And the clearer we see such things, the better the chance of our success. It's actually good news to realize that you're being overwhelmed with thoughts. Some new and useful information. And says not only do we see, he not only says we can see the scattered thoughts, but also how difficult it is to let them go. This is the real eye-opener, how hard it is to let thoughts go. So many of them seem to have, they're sticky. They're about us, maybe about our practice. Surely that's important. Our difficult relationships or any number of things can come into the mind, and it's very hard just to cut them off. And moreover, the longer you indulge it, the longer you sort of let that thought sit before you turn back, the more difficult it becomes. I heard it compared once to someone smoking a cigarette, wearing a sweater, and an ash drops on the sweater. If you brush that off right away, there's no harm done. But you let it sit for even a few seconds, and there's a hole. It really helps to be vigilant and be clear that we're not entertaining thoughts. Even if some of the thoughts might conceivably be useful, if we get in the habit of taking a look at them and, maybe I should let this one go, that's not going to work. There are times for thinking. It's just not when we have our legs crossed on the mat. He says, now in the last 2 days, what have you found to be the most difficult element in practice? Is it when we're dozing off, or is it when we have wandering thoughts? It's a tough question. He says, when sleepiness is the greater problem, it may be due to lack of energy or to a temporary malaise, a cold or a virus. If you are practicing well and a great sleepiness comes, then sometimes there is nothing that can really help. If you become very exhausted, then it is important to take a rest. But if you lack energy through laziness or are merely a little drowsy, then if you increase your breathing, take some fresh air or do some exercises, you may energize yourself. Roshi Kaplow, when he was drowsy, used to fill a sink up with cold water and plunge his head in there and then open his eyes underwater. Just that stimulation would help. And Bodhin Roshi is in the habit of just splashing water into his eyes. He sort of found the short version, the instant version. Moving around, doing some sort of exercise, as Rick mentioned yesterday, some people have found that doing Qigong late at night when they're drowsy can energize them. It's often we become drowsy and we just write it off. Okay, well, I'm tired. You know, if I stay up any later, this is going to get really serious and I won't be able to cope tomorrow. We need to explore those boundaries a little bit, because remarkably, we can push on through a lot of superficial drowsiness and find that we get into an area where the sitting is really wonderful. It says, in fact, Wang Ming doesn't discuss the problem of falling asleep. Perhaps in his day, practitioners never lacked energy. There were some ancient masters that I heard of that would sit in a tree or sit at the edge of a well. You're not going to fall asleep in that situation. The remaining problem is the wandering thoughts. Do you know how to deal with wandering thoughts? The first step is to recognize when the mind is wandering. Often it comes over you so subtly that you do not even notice it. Then suddenly we say, oh, what on earth am I thinking about? So we have to be mindful of what we are doing in our practice. And when we do detect that our minds have wandered, it is important not to feel irritation with it oneself or an aversion towards the thoughts. It simply tires you out if you take up a belligerent attitude towards your own mind. It's another important point. It's a real obstruction for many of us, is just that irritation. Or maybe it's just a feeling of defeat or depression, or we basically are thrown by the fact that we have these thoughts and they catch us up. But really, approach to it, okay, so your mind is full of thoughts. Now you're in the situation of someone who has to clean a dirty room. If you go into a room to clean it and it's dirty, there's no need to feel bad about that. I suppose some people do, you know, it's a reflection on my lousy housekeeping. But really, we just roll up our sleeves and we clean it out. It's the beauty of the practice. It's so clear. Just drop the thoughts. Come back to the practice. He says, the paradoxical thing is that often, very often, as soon as you recognize the fact of wandering, the mind clears. Recognition itself can do the trick. This is the case once we've cleared some of the dead wood away. There are times, we all know, when the thoughts are thick and heavy and you recognize them again and again and again. But for any particular thought, that's definitely true. When you recognize the thought, it often drops away immediately. If it's stickier, then you have to be more diligent. Sometimes the wandering of the mind is due to fatigue or lack of energy. There may be a physiological cause for it. Maybe you do not actually feel drowsy, but nevertheless, the energy for concentration is lacking. The art of it is to recognize again and again the state of mind. If it is wandering, simply bring it back into focus. By doing this again and again, eventually the body energy will be renewed and you will have fewer periods of wandering thoughts. There is a daily cycle of energy. Within some periods, you will have less than at other times. This is natural. There is no need for a fight. Simply be attentively aware at all times. That awareness is the key. We can make use of an analogy here. Meditation is like using a fan, the old-fashioned handheld type. You have the task of catching a feather on the fan. Every time you move the fan, the feather is likely to be blown away. It's a delicate business. You have to hold the fan quite still, just under the space through which the feather is sinking of its own motion. The feather then comes to rest on the top of the fan. You can imagine how difficult or how easy this may be. Any use of force and the feather is lost. Yet once you grasp the principle, it is something very easy to do. Stilling the mind is like catching a feather with a fan. It needs patience and persistence. When practicing, do not be afraid of a distracting thought. If your body has a problem, do not be concerned with it. If your mind is worrying, put the worry down. Keep the mind on the method, waiting for the feather to sink onto the fan. Supposing you are in a very good situation, no distractions, no wandering thoughts. Whatever you do, never congratulate yourself. Away goes the feather at once. So don't be happy. Do not think how successful you are. Just observe the situation without movement towards or away. If the mind moves, wandering thoughts begin. It is delicate. There's some subtlety that needs to be there. Often people try to concentrate in a really rough and physical way, and that may get them a certain distance, but you're not going to settle into a real samadhi until you become very, very still. It's always inspiring for a monitor to walking around the zendo to see someone who's just gone dead still. We're not grabbing anything. We're not trying to grasp anything. If you do, of course, the feather floats away. And yet, it's coming to us. It will open to us. Or in the case of a feather, I guess we can say it'll sink through the air and land on the fan. Another analogy. Some feathers come from chickens, some from ducks. Now, the duck's feather is waterproof. A duck floats happily in water, no trouble. The chicken is a different case altogether. Imagine the state of the feathers of a chicken trying to swim. When we train, the mind begins with feathers like those of a chicken. It is easily disturbed by anything, but in time we find a state where equanimity appears and we are not bothered by any passing thought. At that time, we have duck feathers. Of course, chickens cannot change into ducks, but through practice the mind can become impermeable to the showers of passing thought. Then he goes on with the next quatrain. Protect the branches to save the roots. Though a small matter, it is not trivial. Close the seven orifices. Shut off the six senses. Here the branches are the minor vexations, while the roots are the major ones that may last a lifetime. If one isn't careful with the minor vexations, they may develop into major ones. For instance, you may not be about to rob or kill anyone, yet if the mind is filled by little hatreds or avarice, although you do not act upon these promptings, one day they may propel you to commit a crime. It is important to protect the mind from such a possibility. Not only do we need to be aware of how our minds function when meditating, we need to be mindful in daily life. So many little ways where we let our attention, our concentration leak out. So many little habits that we indulge. Off of them, often habits that are mean-spirited or greedy or don't help others or help ourselves. And of course, those actions that we repeat, they do become habits. And a habit becomes an addiction. There's nothing wrong with drinking. Many people do. It's not a problem. It's a little concerning to get a bit drunk, a little tipsy. But again, many people do. Then maybe we're okay with being falling down drunk now and then. That's hilarious. And then it's a habit, and then we're doing it all the time. And then try and stop. It's not easy. On the other hand, you can say, okay, you know, I can see, I have all these, I can list, I need a second sheet of paper to list all my bad habits. I'll get to work right away. You can't. There's a limit to our willpower. It's sort of like a muscle, and we may have exercised it and strengthened it, and there's a lot that we can do, but there's a point at which we're going to fail. Despite our best intentions, we can't do what we set out to do. So it's important to also have some intelligence. What is it that I need to fix? What's the most important thing here? When we're sitting, when we're practicing, there's no question. The practice is the most important. The koan is the most important. That's where we're putting our attention. Says when meditating, you may put aside evil thoughts, but as you go about the world, they may often assail you. There are many examples of lives full of mistakes of this kind. Some people go into the mountains and practice, maybe for years. Of course, this is something that Cheng Yen himself did. They come to feel that they have gone beyond all greed and hatred. The mind is calm, so how could such negativities arise? They may even feel they have attained liberation. So they come down from the mountains and start interacting again in the world. Quite quickly, they may get irritated by others or form some emotional attachments which they find they cannot handle. Greed and hatred appear, and they are forced to recognize that they still have major vexations. We come out of sesshin often cleansed and with a stillness that we hadn't seen before. But over time, that tends to, the superficial aspects tend to disappear. says, this result occurs because even though people were hidden in the mountains and not experiencing any major trouble, still the minor illusions, the stuff of wandering thoughts, have not been put down. You can see how important it is to cut off even minor wandering thoughts. One who works hard with a method may not be able to cut off all illusory thoughts for all times, but at least he or she can get to the stage of cutting them off for a few seconds, minutes, or hours, or even days. It is important to recognize that your mind can be free from illusion. I used to despair at the thought of how could I stay in a state of complete concentration for days at a time, like you hear in the stories. But really, it only takes a few seconds for us to see with new eyes. And even a few experiences of having the mind fall silent, having the sense of separation drop away, having body and mind become one, as Sheng Yan puts it, can change us, can fortify our faith. We know, now we know, we've seen. This still is not awakening, but it's it shows us what's possible. It's important to recognize that your mind can be free from illusion. When such a person is faced with difficulty in daily life, it becomes easier to recognize the nature of that difficulty. Even as the vexation arises, the practitioner is aware of it and prevents a negative manifestation. But if one fails to practice after returning from the mountains, even though awareness may be present, a manifestation will usually occur. This is why many of us look forward to spending time in retreat or practicing in the mountains. Closing the seven orifices, it's the two eyes, two ears, two nostrils, and the mouth, and shutting off the six senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, taste, touch, and cognition, is the discipline of withdrawal from the attachments we have to worldly things. Such discipline in retreat enables us to perceive how the mind of illusion functions and provides a space in which clarity develops. This is why we have these guidelines in Sesshin. And it's really helpful to take them to heart. Just as an example, when you're walking through the building, maybe you walk by a crowd of people at the water table or something, how alone are you able to make yourself? Can you avoid noticing who's there, what they're doing? Don't really need to pay attention to that. Just walk on by. Wang Ming's poem may be causing some of us a problem. Simon, the cook, was puzzled when I praised the cooking at lunchtime. Simon was worried that his good cooking might be distracting me from meditation. I told him he need not stop cooking delicious food. A dish that tastes good, well, it just tastes good. The message is simply this: don't get attached to it. After you've finished, let it go. You never know. Next time you could be disappointed, and the whole rigmarole of pleasure and disappointment gets going. Then your meditation is indeed disturbed. When Wang Ming tells us to close the orifices and shut down the six senses, he does not mean that we should become senseless zombies, not seeing, hearing, or feeling. What he cautions us against is perpetually wondering what kind of food we will have. Anticipation and disappointment create attachment and greed. When we are engaged in meditation, our practice should not be suffused by attitudes of comparison. Maybe something is good looking, maybe something sounds bad. If it is so, leave it at that. We should act as if what we have seen we have not noticed, and what we have heard we have not regarded. We train ourselves so that the mind does not give rise to comparisons and illusory preferences triggered by the environment. Whatever we have experienced is simply so, is what it is. There is no need to get worked up about it. Perhaps you see a beautiful flower in the hedgerow. You like it, you pick it, you bring it home. Then it fades and dies. Maybe you forgot the water. Every day we hear the baaing of sheep and the bleating of lambs. When the animals are in the yard, there is indeed a great noise like waves breaking on the shore. If you are truly practicing, you witness the sound and nothing more. You will not be thinking, "Oh, how cute the little lambkins are. What a sad sheep that one must be. Perhaps it has lost its lamb." Sheep are in the yard, that's all. When engaged in practice, you need not be concerned with them. I'm reminded of the sesshin. I wasn't at this sesshin, but I certainly heard about it from many different people, where this is on Arnold Park, and a cat got stuck in a tree outside the center. And apparently was up in that tree for several days, meowing piteously. And person after person came to Roshi and Doksan saying, "Can't you do something about that poor cat?" Of course, we called the city, and they said, "The cat will be fine." There's a saying that you never find a cat skeleton in a tree. I've always wondered, though, do you find them at the bottom of the tree? But we have actually at home, we have a window on our stairwell that looks out over the garage roof, and on a couple of occasions, one of our cats has, gotten up in the morning at about 5, and Eloise is at the window looking in. She sees me. And I just tell myself, "You know what? You got up there, I bet you can get back down." And sure enough, by the time I come home, she's home and she's happy. Pay no heed to forms. Do not listen to sounds. Listening to sounds, you become deaf. You become blind observing forms. Shengyan says, there is a deeper meaning here. When you listen to sounds, you interpret them according to your nature. When you observe forms, you likewise create a story about them. But these ideas you have are not the actual reality. The actual nature of the sound we do not hear. The actual nature of form we do not perceive. In that we do not perceive reality, when we look at things, we are as blind. When we hear things, we are as deaf. Understanding the illusory nature of experience, we should not get disturbed by whatever arises. It's quite an advanced state to see things as they are. I like the way he puts it. You likewise create a story about them. We have stories about everything. The mind jumps in and starts interpreting. It's before we even can think about it. One of you has objected that if one lived as blind and deaf, one could not perceive the beauty of the world and could not experience gratitude for life. Pleasure and gratitude are related. Surely it is not wrong to feel gratitude. This is interesting what he says. He says, again, it is important not to be mistaken about Wang Ming's message. We need to understand it with subtlety. He is simply saying that sentiments like gratitude have no place within practice. Before practice and after practice, you experience the pleasures and pains of this world. Gratitude arises, compassion arises, love arises. It is in order to have a clear perception of the natural state that we need to practice without these things. Still, even with this explanation, this can sound hard and cold to people. But if you think about it, here's an example that occurred to me. Let's say you're playing in the U.S. Open and you're receiving serve from Roger Federer. That's not the time to think about gratitude. If you get off the court in one piece, then yes, gratitude can come up. But when we're practicing, when we're sitting, we're making this effort to get to the bottom of the mind, to get past all our thoughts, and to sit on the mat and entertain even the most elevated thoughts is to do something else. When we're sitting, we're sitting. When we're sitting and thinking, we're not really sitting. We're not doing zazen. The natural state is just as it is, naked, unintentional, unadorned by sentiment. We are speaking here of the vital elements of intensive practice, where it is essential for us to have a mind of clarity. In everyday activity, we experience the whole of life, including illusion. Through practice, we can penetrate to the core, and mindfulness can become a part of everyday life too. We are still in the state of the chicken feather. We do not yet perceive the meaning of the phrase in the Heart Sutra, "Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form." In our practice, therefore, it is vital to investigate vigorously. In cutting off the senses, we perceive mind without the intrusion of wandering thought. It is an essential aspect of training. It's really a sacrifice that we make, or we can say it's an offering that we make, to forsake our thoughts. Comes from a mind of devotion. Comes from our faith. Faith in the method. Faith in this tradition. That faith grows as we experience more and more. Next section is entitled Day 3, Early Morning Talk. I have two themes for the day. And then he states them. Every thought, a present moment. Every moment, a rebirth. And then he says, as time passes, you witness the passage of thoughts. As thought succeeds thought, you experience the passage of time. In your practice, it is important to make every thought the present moment. If you make yourself one with the moment, you stop the thought. There is simply experience without time, because without thought, time becomes a continuous present. You have to discover for yourself what being one with the moment actually is. When you make every thought a present moment, there is no continuity of time, no carryover from moment to moment. Everything is continuously fresh, like the water of a spring endlessly bubbling up into the open air. In such practice, every moment is a rebirth. Here we have no thought succeeding thought. Rather, there is endless recreation, an endless continuity without discrete moments. An ancient master said, "One thought for 1,000 years." The Diamond Sutra, I believe, says, mind abiding nowhere flows forth. Those are the words that the sixth patriarch heard when he came to his spontaneous awakening. One thought for 1,000 years, yet in these 1,000 years there are no thoughts. There is simply a continuous, unbroken newness. That is why it is so important for a beginner to cultivate going beyond thought. Therefore, today, focus directly upon the present moment. There is no need to think about it. Just enter the present moment like a diver who has left the springboard. Plunge into it without judgment or consideration. When the diver dives, he lets go. There is only the long fall into the water, which takes no time. Each time you sit down on your cushion, dive into the present moment, becoming thoughtlessly one with it, and you will find that every moment is indeed a rebirth. It is a plunge to let go of our preoccupation with time, not to look past this moment. It can be scary. It can be a little scary. Just as if you're diving into the water, we're usually a little bit nervous, need to screw up our courage before we jump. But once we dive, we let go. There's only the long fall into the water, which takes no time. I'm going to skip over a couple of sections. And we come to day three evening lecture, as Shengyan catches up with us here. Continuing our commentary on Wang Ming's Calming the Mind, we have this stanza. Literature and art are but busy gnats in the air. Technique and ability, a solitary lamp in the sun. And then he explains, whatever our skill or learning, we should not consider ourselves to be extraordinary or our abilities special. There is a Chinese philosopher who said that whereas one's life is limited, knowledge is unlimited. How then can one be proud of attainments? Intelligent people who are learned and proficient in complex disciplines or who practice skills in the arts often think of their activities as the most important in the world. They take pride in their accomplishments and look down on those less skilled. They have the habit of comparing the grandeur of their abilities with the mediocrity of ordinary folk. Doubtless such people are exceptionally talented, but they would have great problems in the practice of Chan. Obviously. Pride, ego, self-protection, and comparison. The accomplished academic, polished in his field and skilled in his discipline, tends to see everything through the perspective of learning. A scientist may see everything from the point of view of an exciting paradigm. A philosopher usually praises a certain school. The artist practicing one style admires it more than others. All such tendencies are actually attachments to self rather than to knowledge. To have developed a skill becomes a mark of what one is, and we defend it by superior attitudes with pride. Such techniques and abilities are like lamps standing in the light of the sun. Being constrained by pride prevents one from becoming one with the sunlight, extending one's mind to infinity. There is a fabulous bird with wings that extend from one horizon to another. In comparison, gnats are insignificant. It helps to have humility. No matter how successful we are. He's speaking here to a particular group of people in Wales. He'll get into that in a moment. Once when I was in Japan, I attended a Zen retreat. In the evening, the master gave a talk. He spent 2 whole hours in scolding me, all because I had a doctorate in literature. As only the Japanese can scold. What is the use of all this reading and scholarship, he said. It is only an obstruction to practice. Such study only leads to arrogance, a belly full of straw. Afterwards, I thought about it and went to see the master. I said, how come you spent so much time scolding me? He replied, if my words had not got to you, you would not have come to see me. I had to acknowledge that this was indeed the case. Too much learning may indeed become an obstruction. At the beginning of this retreat, John, that's John Crook, remarked to me that most of the participants were well-educated and intelligent, and that this in itself could constitute a problem. Is this so? Zen practice softens us. We may continue to have confidence in our ability, take joy in the things that we can do well, but we also have this awareness. There's so much more. I read somewhere that by the timer's bell in some Japanese temples, there's a calligraphy that says, "Not enough. Not yet." To rest on accomplishment is death. It's especially for people who get passed on a koan. It's a dangerous situation. I think with a good teacher, holds your feet to the fire, this can help. But still, what do we want? The joy isn't that I've accomplished this, or, you know, I'm good at that. The joy is in working. To pick it up, to take it up. To meet our difficulties head on. In Sheng Yan's term, to turn our chicken feathers into duck feathers. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.